Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 88 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Fascinating Things, a conversation with Craig Morris, Director of the USDA Western Wheat Quality Lab. The title refers to the fascinating research projects Craig Morris, director of the Wheat Quality Lab, and his collaborators have been conducting at the Pullman Base Facility. Located in a nondescript building on the WSU campus, its claim to fame may be that it sits atop Ferdinand's, the university's very own dairy processing facility. In fact, a typed note on the door lets people know that Ferdinand's cannot be accessed through the Quality Lab facility. A unit of the Agricultural Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the lab is one of four such facilities in the U.S. The other three are located in Manhattan, Kansas, Fargo, North Dakota, and Wooster, Ohio. Their locations pretty much divide the growing regions of the major wheat classes: hard red winter, hard red spring, and soft red winter. Soft white is the smallest of the classes in terms of production, but punches well above its weight when it comes to things like quality, market sophistication, and reputation. One of the reasons for that is the Western Wheat Quality Lab. Morris, who grew up on a corn, soybean, and cattle operation in Iowa, is a bit of a research renegade, but in a good way. Back when his daughters were young, he started coming to work with his wrists festooned with a dozen or more colorful friendship bracelets that children of a certain age are fond of. His daughters are now in their 20s, but he sports a few even now, along with trendy orange-colored frames for his glasses and a soul patch below his lower lip. I've interviewed Morris many times over the years, often about the Washington Grain Commission-funded Genotype and Environment Study, which ranks varieties by quality according to their milling and baking scores. I sat down with Morris for this podcast in May 2018, so listening to our conversation again after several months was like rediscovering something valuable that you forgot you even had. Morris is smart, funny, unflappable, and willing to go with the flow, as was needed when my phone rang a couple of times during our interview, even though I had switched it off. Arr! I've made my conversation with Morris into a two-parter. The first part revolves around our discussion of some fascinating research the Quality Lab is conducting, which has critical implications for the future. I'm speaking specifically about research on the taste of wheat, as well as Morris's efforts that led to the creation of a soft durum wheat. With regard to taste, you'll hear ahead how Morris and ARS research biologist Alicia Koshonis are using mice to determine which wheat varieties taste best. Mice also factor in another part of our conversation, but the story here is about research which looks at the serendipity that has led to the creation of the hard and soft and red and white wheat classes farmers plant today. But we'll start with soft durum. Some quick background: durum has a very hard seed coat, so hard that if you tried to bite into a kernel the way you bite into a kernel of soft white, or even hard red winter, you might break a tooth. Durum's hardness means it isn't milled into flour like regular wheat. Rather, it's transformed into semolina, which looks a little like sand. It is used to make pasta products. Building on the work of a predecessor and working for nearly 20 years to achieve the goal, Morris has created a soft durum which is now commercially available, though not yet in a background that produces many bushels. But there are farmers growing it and places using it. I had a pizza made with flour of soft durum, and it was delicious. I asked Morris to bring listeners up to speed on soft durum development.
Durum wheat formed approximately 500,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent. And it was a natural hybridization between two wild grasses. When that occurred, the genes responsible for soft endosperm were eliminated. They were lost. And that's not uncommon when what we call polyploids form. But nevertheless, those original wild tetraploid wheats evolved in and were selected into what now we understand as durum wheat. One of the most essential features of durum wheat is it has extremely hard kernels. And they are so hard that you can't really make flour out of it. You cannot mill Durham kernels as you would soft white, hard red winter, DNS, etc. They're just too hard. And so from almost the dawn of time, we have used Durham wheat to make semolina, which is this very coarse flour-like product. Similarly, semolina then is in turn used primarily, especially in the United States and Western countries, primarily used to make pasta, spaghetti, elbow macaroni, what have you. And so you could also say that Durham wheat kernels were not extremely hard by design. They were extremely hard by accident. And as humans interact with their foods, in this case durum wheat, they learned how to make semolina and how to use that in pasta. And again, it wasn't by design. It's just how kind of the world works. Well, if one wants to put enough time into it and has the right collaborators with the right expertise, one can take the genes, and there's only two of them, the genes from soft wheat and move them into durum wheat. And that's what we did, again, a couple decades ago. And it's a very long and laborious process, and certainly one I wouldn't have been able to do by myself. We're always quick to point out, for those that might be concerned, that this is all non-GMO technology. But bread wheat, and I use that term loosely because soft white is a, quote, bread wheat, even though we don't bake bread out of it. It's a different species than durum wheat. And you can cross bread wheat and durum wheat, but typically they're not that happy about it. They have different numbers of chromosomes. But you can manipulate those crosses to get some movement, some transfer of genetic material. And essentially, oversimplifications, that's what we did to get those softness genes over into durum. Well, fast forward to a few years ago, and here we are. We have genetically stable, soft durum wheat. And in one way, I think it's very accurate to think that we actually made a new soft white wheat. It is soft. It's got white bran. It's a soft white spring wheat. It's just a different species than our regular soft white wheat.
So will it be grown in what we consider to be Durham country, like North Dakota or the desert southwest, or will it be grown around here?
We're currently growing soft Durham commercially in the PNW. It's currently being grown commercially in the desert southwest. I think one could argue that eventually, and who knows what eventually is, it 10 years or is it 100 years, eventually it will replace probably all Durham wheat. And the reason I say that is because through all of our research over many years, we have not found a single reason or a single advantage of having very hard kernels. And so, in a sense, you could say, well, over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, humans just learned to deal with it. But from a technological standpoint, whether it's milling, whether it's pasta manufacture, whether it's we have not identified a single advantage of hard kernel. Conversely, soft kernel provides many, many technological advantages.
Now, have you gotten any overseas interest in the soft durum?
We have quite a bit, and I think that the people growing it commercially have had certainly interest in buying commercial quantities. And to the best of my knowledge, none of those sales have been finalized. But I have sent literally dozens of samples, not only to the Far East, but to North Africa, various places, as well as domestic users. And again, from a technological standpoint, it's always evaluated, rated very high, and there's tremendous keen interest in it. So,
now, in the U.S., we have the infrastructure to grind durum into semolina, and there would be no advantage for these companies to replace all of their equipment, correct?
That's a good point. I mean, in some sense, it's sort of like Well, are you going to import cars from Australia or UK because the steering wheel's on the wrong side? So yeah, I mean, if the way pasta is produced currently on a very large commercial scale in the United States, more often than not, there's actually a Durham mill right across the street with a big pipe blowing semolina pneumatically over to the pasta plant. And so, you know, that represents millions of dollars of capital investment. And so you really have to ask yourself, what would elicit a change in that situation? I think currently the biggest hurdle to get over is, again, this existing capital that's sitting there in terms of infrastructure. That said, I can point to South Korea, which, best of my knowledge, does not have a single Durham mill in the whole country. And so we don't generally think of Koreans as big pasta eaters, for example, in contrast to the Italians or even the Americans. But globally, no matter where you go, there's greater interest and increasing and growing interest in Western types of foods. And you could almost in quotes put ethnic foods. And so is spaghetti being eaten in Korea? Absolutely. Where does it come from? Well, I'm not sure I can say, but I know for sure it doesn't come from semolina that is milled in country. And so to extend that sort of scenario, obviously for many, many years, they have been milling soft white and Western white very expertly, very efficiently. They know how to do it. They're set up for doing that. And so that milling capacity exists. Going back to the idea that soft Durham is really a soft white spring wheat, it mills identical to soft white.
We think of wheat as wheat. You have been doing research looking at the taste of wheat. Can you tell us, does the taste differ?
We believe it does. If you go into the scientific literature, there's very sort of inconsistent and largely, I'm going to say, anecdotal studies in terms of the flavor of wheat. And most of them, not surprisingly, might be, well, we baked a couple of loaves of bread from a hard red whole wheat and a white whole wheat, and some panelists thought they tasted different, you know, something like that. Very sort of a little bit hit or miss, and not to criticize those studies, but it's a very difficult subject to study and to study well, primarily because of the cost and complexity of running human sensory panels. In other words, having either large groups of people that are willing to just try different breads, for example, breads, or to actually train and have a set of a sensory panel that's highly trained in the nuances of flavor. And when you step back and think about it, and think about, like, let's think about the apple industry. Can you imagine breeding new apple varieties and not considering how they taste? I mean, it's almost ludicrous, right? Well, probably close to 15 years or more ago, I was invited to give a lecture at the Bell Institute for General Mills in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I believe the very first question is, after I had described how we breed new wheat varieties, et cetera, and the question was, well, what are you doing for flavor? And I was a little bit taken aback, and I had to answer truthfully, nobody breeds wheat varieties for how they taste. But it did get me to thinking, and to make a long story short, it came about that we actually used mice, laboratory mice, inbred strains of mice, as a model system to accurately and objectively evaluate the flavor in terms of preference and desirability of different wheat varieties. And to sort of summarize quite a bit of research, it's very repeatable. Varieties have tremendously different differences. It's consistent over environments, locations. Some of the more recent work that Dr. Alicia Koshona has done, we've actually now identified what we call QTLs, or quantitative trait loci, which seem to have a very large and significant effect on this consumption difference, ostensibly flavor. That has more recently evolved into a competitive grant that Alicia and I obtained to do a large consumer trial at the Denver Museum of Natural History. And so that will be occurring this fall. They're very good at running consumer trials. They have I believe it's a food technology lab or something there as part of the museum. And so we're really excited about that. The question typically we get are, well, do mice perceive the same flavor that humans do? And you can read tomes on the morphology and biochemistry of and genetics of taste buds and flavor. And to oversimplify a little bit, there's much more commonality amongst all mammals and their ability to taste than there are differences. But that still doesn't answer the questions of, are these going to taste different to humans? It's entirely possible, and we'll wait and see, that mice are actually more sensitive than humans. But clearly, not all humans have the same sensitivity. We've all heard about super tasters, and some of the people listening may be super tasters. So it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. But clearly, that's going to be sort of this more validation of these years of work using the mouse model system.
Now, don't you have a theory about how red and white wheat came to be, that the mice didn't like the taste of the red wheat, and so therefore there was more of it left over?
That's entirely possible. Again, we think about when bread wheat first formed, it all had red bran. And so did, you know, humans prefer the white bran varieties? That I don't know. Something, though, related to the mouse, we call it the mouse model, was that we observed that mice don't like hard wheat. To give a very, very brief primer on sort of wheat genetics, when bread wheat first formed, we had already talked a little bit about how white durum is very hard, because when it first formed and evolved, it lost its genes for hardness. Bread wheat, of course, is a natural hybrid between durum wheat and goat grass. And I will tell the listeners that goat grass has soft endosperm. And it has those genes for soft endosperm, the same ones that we moved into durum. We clearly understand that when bread wheat first formed, it too was soft. And it was soft because of the restoration of the softness trait from the goat grass. The listener may ask, well, I thought most of the wheat around the world is hard wheat, hard bread wheat, hard red winter, hard red spring, etc. And that's true, but then where did hard wheat come from? Well, we know from a genetic standpoint, every hard wheat known to humans exists because there has been a mutation in one of these two genes for soft endosperm. So the curious thing is, we have never come up with any reason why those mutations would persist. And if we think in a bit of a Darwinian sense, mutations happen all the time. Most are deleterious. Very few are actually selected for and remain in a population. And so we know that those softness genes mutated, but why did they persist? Why did they stick around? They seemingly have no advantage from an agronomic, a yield, you know, winter hardiness, drought resistance, disease resistance, nothing we can put our finger on. Going back to our mouse model, though, we observe that mice don't like hard wheat. If you mix soft and hard wheat together, they will go through and eat every last soft kernel and leave the hard until they're obliged to have to eat it. So anyway, for those who might be interested, we actually published a scientific study on that, demonstrating that at very, very low frequency, mice are able to select not directly for the hard wheat, but indirectly because they eat all the soft ones.
Which might be the reason why there's more red wheat in the world than soft white, right?
It's possible. That's actually another interesting story in the sense that, and let's think specifically about the United States, why do hard red spring and hard red winter wheats dominate the milling and baking industry? In large part, the answer has to do with white settlement in the Great Plains of the United States back in the 1800s, where wheats that were brought from Eastern Europe along with the colonists, pioneers, brought those wheats with them, and those wheats had been very well adapted to, you can imagine, the Ukraine, Western Russia, Southwestern Russia, and those climates there, very, very similar to the U.S. Great Plains. And so the varieties thrived. They just happened to be hard and red. They could have just as easily been soft and white. So that's a little bit of an accident of history. And once the milling and baking industry became accustomed to using those wheats and found them to be superior in terms of gluten strength and bread baking, they become well established. And so, but again, it's a little bit of a historical artifact.
I want to swing back to the taste question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we are on the cusp of actually marketing wheat by taste?
There's actually, on some level, there's wheat. It's currently happening, but much more on a sort of an anecdotal level. I mean, for people out there in the audience that may be into, quote, you know, heirloom varieties, or if even if you're not into heirloom varieties, go on the World Wide Web and start Googling around for heirloom wheat varieties. And they are typically old varieties. They are typically, at this point in time, not competitive for yield, probably don't have very good disease resistance, but they are purported in either a perhaps true, but certainly at an emotional level, that these old heirloom varieties taste better. I think somehow coupled with that is the notion that if we grow tomatoes that my grandmother grew, they will just taste better, period. And so seemingly the same idea with heirloom varieties, they've got to taste better, right? Because they're old. So may or may not be true. I don't know that there's any scientific basis for it.
But isn't that what your work is ultimately looking at?
I think where we would like to try to get is that, and I'm going to flip this inside out, I think that most likely we will identify genes, these QTLs, that are responsible for making compounds, substances, if you will, that taste bad. And so will we make wheat taste better? Yes, but it's really, in a sense, getting rid of genes that make taste wheat bad or bitter. Now, again, wheat is not around to necessarily feed us. Wheat has its own thing going. We've obviously manipulated it over the years genetically. But whether it's wheat or any other plant, they don't want to be eaten, whether it's insects or what have you. And so throughout the plant kingdom, there's various strategies to defend itself. And one is certainly to have bad-tasting chemicals, compounds, in your seed. You know, quinoa is a great example. There's compounds called saponins. And, boy, talking about bitter, you ever taste an unwashed quinoa seed and you'll regret the day it happened. So I think, again, kind of just, again, to summarize, I think we may get to the point where we can identify a couple of major genes that, and we can interrupt those, essentially breed wheat that doesn't have those genes, and it will taste better. I will say that I think that there will be a continuing increase in interest in whole grain products. And perhaps we would all agree that white flour has essentially no taste. Whether you think whole wheat tastes good or doesn't taste good, it's largely because we've included the bran. And that's where, again, anecdotally, do white wheats taste better or sweeter than red wheats? Maybe. But using our mouse model, we have found tremendous differences amongst white wheats and tremendous differences amongst red wheats. So it doesn't go lockstep with bran color.
Is there any wheat that you can point to, any variety, and say, the mice like that one?
We do have a list of the winners, as it were. One of our early studies, we kiddingly or jokingly referred to it as March Madness, just because that was actually the statistical design. These models, these experiments are conducted by mixing variety A with variety B, give it to the mice. Which one do they eat? Well, they ate all of A. They didn't like B. And so that's kind of how it works. So essentially that's the same as a structured pairing like we do in basketball, right? So A and B play. If A wins, A advances. A's going to play the winner of C and D, right? So, yeah.
And any variety that you can recall that the mice particularly liked?
Sticks in my mind that Louise, which is currently our leading soft white spring wheat in Washington State, was one of the top winners. I don't know if it's the overall grand champion, but
okay. You heard it here, folks. As Tony the Tiger might say, Louise tastes great. For careful listeners of this podcast, I think there are takeaways that could potentially be monetized. A fancy word for turning something into money. In the case of Soft Durum, remember, the Northwest has transitioned between wheat classes before. Turkey Red arrived with Mennonite immigrants from Eastern Europe in the 1870s. Then club wheat dominated the landscape. It's only been since the 1960s that soft white has become the region's preeminent wheat class. Could the Northwest someday become the soft Durum capital of the world? Certainly, we are in an advantageous position, what with the person who created Soft Durum working as director of the Western Wheat Quality Lab in the heart of the Palouse. As for taste, it's fascinating to me that such an obvious question has not been asked before. Did you hear Morris talk about apple breeders and how it would be unfathomable for them not to consider taste in the development of a new variety? The wheat market is diversifying. The Northwest may be in a positive position on the quality front now, but that lead is eroding, and we can't depend on using it as our calling card forever. It only makes sense to create varieties of wheat that provide a flavorful advantage. That's all the time we have. I hope you've enjoyed episode 88 of Wheat All About It, or what I've entitled Fascinating Things, a conversation with Craig Morris, director of the USDA Western Wheat Quality Lab. Please join me again next week for the second part of my conversation with Morris in Fascinating Things 2, here on Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead through a history of starvation.
Lots of problems when we have enough to eat. But there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.